Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Kia ora koutou, ko Julie Ferry tuku ingoa, ko maunga o Ika te maunga, ko Wairau te awa, ko Waitemata te whanga, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, my name's Julie Ferry and I'm one of five Roskill Community Voice Reps on the Pukitāpapa Local Board of Auckland Council. I'm part of the City Vision Centre-Left whānau and I have a monthly spot here on Red Alert Radio. I'm very keen to get your feedback and you can find me quite easily on social media because I have a strange last name. It's spelt F for Fred, A-I-R-E-Y, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook. And I'm also on Instagram, although I'm not very good at Instagram yet. Now, we also have a Red Alert Radio Facebook page. If you search for Red Alert Radio AKL, you should find us pretty easily. We put up links to these shows as podcasts once they're up online, as well as other bits of useful news relevant to the topics we cover. You can get all of our past shows on the Red Alert Radio archive on planetaudio.org.nz as well. Now today, I'm talking with Julia Maskell, who is running for the Albert Eden Local Board, one of my ticket mates with City Vision. She has a background in environmental law, including advocacy around fines for pollution, which we'll hopefully talk a little bit about. And she has strong connections to the Owairaka area, including serving on a number of local school boards. Thanks for joining me today, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first up, tell us a little bit more about your day job, which is around environmental law and planning. And I always think it's great to have a planner on the team, on the ticket, because planning is, you actually end up as a local board member doing a lot of stuff that's in that planning space. You don't need to be an expert because the staff help you with that. But having someone who understands planning speak, and in your case, particularly how it pertains to environmental law, I think will be fantastically useful. So tell us a bit more about that.
Okay, well, last year I graduated with a Masters of Environmental Law from University of Auckland. And since then, since I graduated, I've been working for some of the senior lecturers in the University of Auckland Architecture and Planning School in the planning side of things. So one of the research papers I did in my Masters was about the Resource Management Act, and that was a real eye-opener for me about just the importance of practical decision making at the local level. Previously, my other papers were all about national level kind of policy and legislation. But the last paper was a real eye opener because that was about what really happens on the ground at local government and how level and how important that is. So the research that I've been doing in my day job has been to do with local government and its environmental role through the planning system and in connection with climate change.
Right.
So right now what I'm writing up this week is the product of a couple of workshops which are across the university. The participants have come from psychology department, science department, public health, as well as planning and architecture. And the participants have been discussing the response that they would like to make to Auckland Council's climate action framework, which they published subsequent to the July declaration of the climate emergency. So in terms of the law, participants are talking a lot about what they think Auckland Council should be doing. Of course, there are legal constraints about what Auckland Council can do. So that's the environmental law bit, is what does the Resource Management Act say that councils can do? What limits are there on councils' actions in response to climate change? And should council be advocating for legislative change? Or should council just be focusing on what they can do through the planning system, for example?
So you mentioned there the Auckland Climate Action Framework. And that's open for consultation now.
Yes, and that's right.
Yeah, I think it's open. It's open for quite a long period, so it's one of those ones where I think some people might forget about it because they're like, "Oh, I've got plenty of time to do that." But please don't forget. We'll put a link up on the Facebook page.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I don't think it's a very long period. I think it's a matter of weeks, not months. And it's definitely it's a very complex issue for people to get their heads around. So,
And you mentioned there the relationship with public health, and I think that's something that people, particularly in Aotearoa, tend not to think about with climate change. We think about, oh, you know, there's going to be flooding, or things are going to be drier or wetter or hotter, but people don't tend to, I think, then take that next step of thinking about the impact that that would have on health.
Yeah.
What are the things, some of the things that you've observed in that conversation so far?
Well, two of the big things are that there will be different diseases.
Right,
So there's the possibility of the mosquito-borne semi-tropical diseases, or that they may make an appearance here, which they haven't in the past.
Like malaria.
There's other ones. I won't name them
okay.
Because I can't remember which ones they are.
That's right.
But it's a real risk, which is taken very seriously. So it doesn't have to be too many degrees temperature increase for them to become viable as part of the ecosystem, whether we like it or not. And the other thing is that heat itself is a major cause of elderly people in particularly. Puts stress on your heart and other vital organs. So just increased temperature can be very difficult for people to cope with, for their bodies to cope with.
And I suppose then that, in turn, has both those things have implications for planning in terms of, if you've got issues with mosquito-borne, you've got illnesses, you've got issues about standing water and how we design and plan things so that that's not so much of a risk. And then with the heat, you've got an issue around how do we keep our homes cool. You know, we've had so much focus on insulating things to keep them dry and warm. And while that, you know, is still really important, there's the flip side of that of being able to keep people cool in summer as well.
Yeah, and of course tree and foliage.
Yeah.
That's a big issue for Auckland. We used to have a blanket prohibition on cutting trees down for development. Now it's the other way around. It's blanket permission and less protected. And the tree coverage has come right down. Obviously, there's a big plan to the million trees push is a very important one, particularly for carbon sequestration. But that doesn't necessarily answer the question about what it feels like to walk around on footpaths if you've in the heat, if you've lost your trees by the sides of the road, and also trees by houses that are naturally cooling influence as well.
And that ability to play outside underneath trees as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. But of course we're busy intensifying our development, which we absolutely have to do.
Yeah.
And that's got climate change benefits because of reduction of emissions when we've got people travelling fewer distances. So we have to intensify. I'd like to see as much as we can do to protect trees as part of the mix and green spaces, but it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's an interesting balance. So I got a little bit distracted there, folks. One of the things you've mentioned there around environmental law and the Resource Management Act, and I did some study of this at university a long time ago, I was thinking about how Auckland Council structure has changed, and that's probably something that came up in your study in terms of, you know, we used to have the Auckland Regional Council, and that's where a lot of the environmental functions sat. But my observation is that with the new Auckland Council model, it's not that new, it's been around for 9 years, but, you know, feels new still, is that actually a lot of those environmental functions are now coming down to local boards and to the lower level. And I think actually that's quite a good thing, because there is, you know, whenever you have a planting day or you talk to people about pest plants or illegal dumping, or, you know, there's a very strong interest from the local community in their own local patch. And so, you know, have you sort of observed that in terms of the way some things are set up to operate at that regional level? But in Auckland, we don't have we do sort of have a regional council, but they're not as active in that environmental space. Does that have an impact on planning and what you might be recommending through the climate framework in those discussions?
That's a very good question, and I haven't thought about it in quite those terms. The regional council in some areas where we've got, where there is still a division between the territorial authority, the district council,
yep,
and the regional council. The regional council in one area where I interviewed the engineers about coastal communities.
Yeah.
There, one of the people I spoke to there who's very senior said that the regional council really advocates much more strongly for the environment.
Yeah.
Than the district council does.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it's ended up in Auckland. I think 9 years is a short time probably, yeah, in terms of this kind of realignment. But certainly at the local level, I'm really impressed with the local groups, yeah, and the local boards have got the power to give support, financial support, and yeah, practical hands-on support. Councils, councillors and local board members actually physically turn up,
yeah,
and support,
yeah,
the community. So it's moral support as well as financial support for local initiatives.
Yeah.
And there's enormous work being done in Oaraka around Oakley Creek, etc., with all the cleaning up. But whether or not the big decisions, for example, should we be tolerating any extension to the residential zones,
right,
on,
yeah,
the rural,
yeah,
urban boundary, the fact that Auckland Council is a unitary authority,
mm,
I don't know. I think that that possibly the pressures to provide housing and dealings with central government around that, I'm not sure who's advocating,
yeah,
specifically for the environment within council at the moment.
And one part of the environment that I think we've just recently seen some expansion out into Pukekohe, where, you know, we're losing you know, soil that we actually need to grow food to housing. And it's not like, you know, you, to a certain extent, you can kind of put housing anywhere, not anywhere, anywhere, but, you know, you've got more options, but you can't take that good growing soil and put it somewhere else. You can't, in a short period of time, create those kinds of soils in other areas.
Well, yeah, actually, once those soils, those versatile soils, have been built on, the you cannot regenerate,
yeah,
that natural resource. So it's permanent damage. You can mitigate the damage. You can move the topsoil, but I'm not sure that that always happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Pukekohe situation is, it's surprising to me that the balance has fallen with quite such a large expansion of,
yeah,
of residential zoning into that area. I think that to protect the soils is one of the most important issues that we have got in New Zealand. I did do a little bit of research around this, and I was shocked how small the patches on the maps of New Zealand are, which indicate which are the fertile areas.
Yeah.
If you look from an aeroplane window, we shouldn't be flying, but if, yep, if you do, you can see all this massive undeveloped land, and it's tempting to think, oh, I'm sure you could put some fertilizer or something organic on there and make, yep, it grow. But the fact is that a lot of the soils in New Zealand are not north facing to start off with.
Right.
They are on hillside. So to be flat and north facing, versatile soils, as there are in Pukekohe, is a very rare thing indeed.
Right.
And for example, the potato crop there,
yep,
I understand that there are times of the year when Pukekohe provides potatoes for the whole of New Zealand. I might have got that wrong, but that's very high importance because it's rare.
Yeah. And one of the things, thinking about, you know, you mentioned before about climate change, you know, we will need to fly less. And what that also means is not just shifting people by air less, but also shifting food by air less. And it seems to me that it's quite short-sighted to reduce our growing capacity as a country when we know that in 5, 10, 15, 20 years we're going to be able to import a lot less of our food as well.
I think it's extremely short-sighted. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess all those houses, they're all going to have great veggie patches, but that's not really the answer, is it?
It's not really. I mean, there are things that can be done within the CBD. You can, you know, those excellent initiatives, which council is supports, making land available, council land available for local initiatives to practice regenerative farming practices. But that is very good socially, and it's very good educationally. But in terms of providing the large scale crops that we need to feed the whole population, it's less of a contribution than the larger scale areas. And areas like Pukekohe also, I mean, They do tend to produce for the export market.
Yes.
So there is a possibility that I think that council could give some incentives in some way to producing for the domestic market.
So the sort of, you know, we're talking about regional and national issues, but coming down a bit to Owaraka itself. So what's your sort of connection here? What's your background in Owaraka? How long have you lived here?
Well, my partner and I came back to New Zealand from London, where we'd been working just for a year. We were very pleased to get back here, and we were able to choose which part of New Zealand to live in, and we chose to live in Auckland, although my partner's from Hawke's Bay, and I'd most recently been in Wellington. So first of all, we flattered in Epsom, and then we were able to buy a house in Kingsland. It was a slightly renovated, drafty villa.
Yeah.
It wasn't really big enough for more than just the two of us, so then we moved, after a couple of years when we started having children, we moved to Owaraka proper, just opposite Pack and Save. So, and we've been there for, well, an awfully long time. My eldest daughter's now 28, and she had her first birthday there.
Wow. Oh, that's great. It's when you stay in a place for a long time, there's connections and opportunities you can explore, and it's something that sort of just in the back of my mind worries me about the fact that so many people are having to rent now and having insecure housing, is there's that inability to form those strong connections. I mentioned before you've been on some local school boards. It's quite... I've never been on a school board. I've never run for a school board. Something I had sort of thought I might do when my kids got a bit older, but then I sort of fell into local government, and that sort of takes up a lot of that space of my life. What do you feel you bring from that experience from being on school boards?
Well, when you're elected, you're elected by parents, and you better listen to what parents have to say.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Even though the trouble with having a law degree is that there's this idea that you need to have a lawyer on the board.
A lawyer and an accountant.
So in both cases, I was asked to stand rather than volunteered to stand in the first place. But once I got into the role, I really started to appreciate the gold, which is community participation, and really listening to people about what the issues are. And the best bit is listening to people's suggestions for dealing with those issues.
Yeah,
because it's people have brilliant ideas when it's their lived experience of what they're coping with. So that's what I believe that's... I've done other things. I've taken that enthusiasm for hearing what people have to say about decisions that affect them. I've done research, community safety research as well, in central Taranaki and in Whanganui. And the same thing applies. People know what is important to them, and they have really good ideas about what can be done.
Yeah.
So that's what I hope to bring to, if I'm successful and I get elected to the local board, it's that trust that people know what can be done to make things better, and not just for themselves, but for people around them too.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you say that, because that's one of my sort of things I'm quite passionate about in terms of local democracy, is that it's not just you vote every 3 years, it's also all of those processes and conversations in between, which actually, you know, more and more should give our community more power. I mean, if it was up to me, you know, I think local boards would spend most of their time and effort on consultation and engagement, and then how you collate that and turn that into a plan or, you know, a framework or a document, and then to make it happen, you know, and then refreshing it and checking in. And, you know, I think that's really where, like you say, the gold is. Yeah, and where you can, as a local board, help the community to make a real difference and change things for the better over time.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are reluctant to complain. So they'll, in the first place, say that everything's okay. You have to be very patient when you're consulting with people. Also, people are, if things are going badly for them and they're experiencing pain, then there's fear and there's outrage, and people take pretty extreme positions, and they may come along to community consultation meetings and have a whole level of emotion that this is an opportunity to express.
Yeah,
it doesn't invalidate that they may have got be really well informed and have got tremendously valuable things to participate, to contribute.
Yeah.
So you have to see what's really going on for people. There is an emotional level that people feel frustrated and disempowered.
Yeah.
And if we're genuinely going to consult, we have to expect that we'll get told off, roundly told off.
Yeah.
It's in many situations, and because you're there, if you're representing decision makers, and decision makers have been making decisions that hurt, then you are going to get that at the first level. But if you're patient and allow that to be expressed, the next level can be something altogether different, and looking to the future once the past feelings about the past have been expressed.
Yeah, there's a so I don't know if you've ever watched Parks and Rec.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And, Leslie Knope, my hero.
Yeah, yeah, she's great. And you know, I want to be her when I grow up. But she, right in the very first episode, they have a town hall meeting, and you know, there's people yelling at them, and she says that quote that gets used a lot, that, you know, when I hear yelling, I hear people caring loudly.
Exactly.
And local government can be quite like that sometimes, in terms of people do care at you loudly, and then part of the role is to take that on board and acknowledge it, and then go, okay, what do we do next?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, and how do we do that together?
Absolutely. And some of the issues which people bring up are ones that are in the echo chamber of the internet, etc. They realise that there's a lot of shared outrage, and they just join in the stridency over a particular issue.
Yeah.
And so you have to hear that one through. But then the individuals, they've got different views as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit ritualistic. I'm not minimising it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's in, 'cause my background is in the union movement, and we used to talk about, you know, when you're having a conversation with a person and they're upset about something, how you sort of shift that from anger to hope of, you know, that actually, you know, there's the anger, which is totally justified, and you're not minimising it. How do we turn that into a hope of change?
Yeah.
And then the next step is to take action to make that change, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if we don't turn anger to hope, or we don't give people hope, yeah, we don't listen to them and show them that change can happen as a result of their anger, you know, that things can get better, then that turns to apathy, and people just switch off and disengage from the process. They have their anger, but they have nowhere to take it.
Absolutely. And then that can be channeled in very negative ways. I think that this is it's a very serious issue that we're faced with. I mean, it all connects with the terrible occurrence on March 15th this year in Christchurch. I think that comes, I'm no expert, But there is a feeling of disempowerment, which has led to all sorts of surprises in elections such as Brexit and Donald Trump being elected and the recent Australian elections.
Yeah.
So these people have apparently come from nowhere with their anti-progressive ideas in the electorate. But I think it's there, and we have to listen to people. Disempowerment is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, and it's interesting how it manifests differently, I think, in different parts of the community as well, where parts of the community, like you said before about people don't like to complain, and it's one of the things in Puketapapa, we've historically had some of the lowest levels of participation in traditional council processes. Sometimes Waiheke would get more submissions on things than we would, despite the fact that we have about 10 times the population. And so that's something that, as a local board, there's been a lot of focus on, is how do we actually, firstly, do that and do things in a different way so that people can have input and through different mechanisms, because the traditional ones didn't necessarily work, but also so that they can express themselves and then see the outcome of that expression. Because if you're already in a situation where, say, you're a migrant to the country, or in particular if you've come from a situation where you've got a refugee background, which is not uncommon in my community, and you get a brick wall, you just stop. You know, you don't keep going and find another way to do it. You just stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we lose that. We lose that voice, and that person loses that opportunity to make change that would be better for them and their family as
well.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think one of the things that really concerns me is that there are people who are kind of living off the radar, who are so disconnected that it's a million miles away from them to think that they might make submissions on something called local government plans. The complexity of the relationship between the local board and council and what local government is compared with national government, I think, is something which we have to be really aware of and respect the fact that it's complex and people haven't necessarily been engaged in trying to work out what on earth's going on. So I think that's a responsibility that we all have who are interested in local government, to try and communicate why it matters.
Yeah, and that's I see that as a big part of the project of local boards, actually. So we're coming up to the end in a minute or two. Just quickly, you're running for Albert Eden Local Board with the City Vision ticket. And how do you see that as an opportunity to make change? Just, you know, in a minute.
In a minute. Well, the great thing about City Vision is that it's a coalition. It's a coalition of Labour and Greens and some community independents. So that mirrors the national level of coalition.
Yeah.
And I think having a coalition has got real strengths. It means we have to listen to each other, which is good modelling for ourselves when we should be listening to the community as well.
That's a good point.
I'm really lucky we've got two longer-standing local board members. We've got Margie Watson and Graham East, and there are two vacancies. So I'm standing with Christina Robertson for one of the vacancies. So we're new candidates, the two of us. So for me, it's an opportunity to learn. Really, that's the most that's really important, opportunity to learn from these experienced and marvellous local board members and Councillor Cathy Casey. For me, I want to be able to use my energy. It's a real opportunity to use my energy for the environment and for social justice. And social justice and the environment, when they're together, well, the trouble is that people who have the least suffer the most in environmental damage. So the opportunity to spread the benefit of environmental protection as broadly as possible into our communities. Awaraka is a very very stratified. We've got people who have very low incomes as well as people have very high incomes, and for me, an opportunity to spread lovely green spaces right around Fairleigh. That's what I'm keen on.
Great. Thank you so much, Julia. I really appreciate you coming in today to have a chat, and best of luck for the local government elections in October.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks, and I'd love to hear your feedback. A reminder, you can listen to this interview or any of our back catalogue at planetaudio.org.nz. Check out programs, and we are under R. So, ka kite anō.
Get together next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.